From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is away again this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
WikiLeaks.org, a whistleblower website, has published what it says are nearly 92,000 official U.S. documents
filed about the war in Afghanistan from 2004 to 2009. Raw data from the front line.
It poses a very real and potential threat to those that are working hard every day to keep us safe.
Some 91,000 documents related to the U.S. war in Afghanistan were released last Sunday, minus 15,000 they delayed for, quote, harm minimization reasons. The political and military impact won't be known for some time, but the single largest leak of classified documents in U.S. history is a tremendous display of power by the self-described whistleblower site WikiLeaks, which paired with three news outlets, The New York Times, The Guardian, and Der Spiegel, for as wide a reach as possible. According to two of those internal military memos leaked by WikiLeaks, on August 25th, 2009, the 2nd Battalion, 8th Marines Echo Company in Afghanistan exchanged small arms fire, or SAF, with the enemy, or EN. The documents itemize each instance of SAF from each specific location and conclude their account with the bomb that was finally used. In U.S. military terms, Primal 3-1 Harrier dropped one GBU-12 on the compound, effectively suppressing the EN threat. But according to Noah Shackman of Wired magazine, who was with Echo Company during the firefights, this step-by-step military account only tells a fraction of the story.
The sort of critical moment in the documents is that a Harrier jet dropped a 500-pound laser-guided bomb on a compound, and it says the threat was suppressed. But what it doesn't say is how many times the captain opted not to use that bomb because, one, he was worried about the damage to civilian life or to civilian property. And two, the rule set down by General Stanley McChrystal, his boss's 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 boss, said that you really can't use air power in any instance unless it's really, really, really critical. And then when the captain finally did decide to drop that bomb, it says the enemy threat was suppressed. But the suppression only lasted 17 minutes, and then the fighting started again. What the documents don't even allude to is while this American captain was fighting the fight, his British counterpart and his Afghan counterpart were in the nearby villages sitting down with local elders trying to gain their support.
What else do you think was missing?
One of the important things missing was just in how much danger the Marines were there. These guys were surrounded. And yet still their captain held off from dropping a bomb that might have ended the conflict instantly. You know, there were bullets flying by people's heads and missing by inches.
These memos that were released were basically written from someone in the field to his boss or her boss.
Yeah, and I think we've all got experience with inner office memos, and they don't always tell what's going on in the office. Readers might be led to believe that all that's going on in Afghanistan is people shooting each other or blowing stuff up, and that's just not the case.
So what do the documents say about the military's own internal communications?
They say that they've got to change. The military is still talking to itself as if blowing up stuff and shooting guys are the most important metrics, and in a fight like this, they're not. David Kilcullen, who's a big theorist of counterinsurgency and a practitioner too, talks about counterinsurgencies as a wide scope of conflict that starts from armed coercion to more soft political persuasion. Military's communication these days only seems to concentrate on the armed coercion part, but until it encompasses all of it, it's not really going to get at this larger competition.
What do you think readers should bring to these documents when they read them?
I think they've got to bring a critical eye. They can't be duped into thinking that this is the raw, unvarnished capital T truth. What they're reading is just kind of an echo of what actually went on.
Noah, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Noah Shackman writes for Wired magazine, WikiLeaks has demonstrated its ability to flout U.S. law by being, in effect, stateless, guided by different priorities than the more traditional advocates of sunlight. It lives by the rules of the Internet. Here's Julian Assange, WikiLeaks founder, explaining his code of conduct.
We're an activist organization. The method is transparency. The goal is justice.
Stephen Aftergood is the longtime writer of the email newsletter and blog, Secrecy News. For years, he's reported and researched government secrecy and advocated for U.S. government transparency. He's no stranger to the antagonism between secrecy and disclosure. But in recent months, he's been a critic of WikiLeaks and its methods. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So in June, you wrote a blog post offering some praise for WikiLeaks, but you didn't mince words when it came to its failings. You wrote, quote, "It is not whistleblowing and it is not journalism. It is a kind of information vandalism."
What I was responding to there was a pattern of activity by WikiLeaks in which they were disclosing confidential records of social and religious groups like the Masons and the Mormons and several others, that did not reveal any misconduct. And it seemed to me that they were using the posture of transparency as a kind of weapon against disfavored groups. And to me, that was a really repugnant thing to do.
What about the video of the Apache helicopter attack in Iraq in 2007 that WikiLeaks leaked in April?
Well, that I thought was a perfectly legitimate disclosure. I wish the Pentagon had released it when they had been asked to do so. The problem I had there with WikiLeaks was that they edited and presented an excerpt from the longer video in what I thought was a heavy-handed propagandistic fashion, starting with the name they gave to the video, Collateral Murder. I thought they undermined their own presentation by the way they packaged it.
So, to this week, WikiLeaks offered the material first to three major news outlets, and all of them and WikiLeaks decided to withhold certain names and details to protect people. Is this a sign that WikiLeaks is maturing, or did it just cave in to pressure from the news outlets?
The mere fact that they acknowledged that there might be reasons to withhold certain records is a very important concession. It means that transparency is not the unique and overriding value, but that it needs to be factored in along with others, such as security and privacy.
On the other hand, those names, those details that might endanger somebody are probably going to be released by WikiLeaks.
Whenever you do a wholesale release of enormous quantities of confidential or classified records, you run serious risks. And they're not risks to WikiLeaks, they are risks to individuals who might be named in those records, to U.S. relations with allies, to intelligence networks. It is not risk-free.
You've developed your own tacit list of what should or shouldn't be disclosed when it comes to secret information. How has your behavior evolved over these years?
I have been willing to do what WikiLeaks up to this point has refrained from doing, consult with government agencies that may have originated the information when we're talking about currently classified records. A document that seems utterly benign may nevertheless reveal significant information that could pose a threat when viewed by either an opponent or a skilled analyst. That doesn't mean you yield your decision-making power or your news judgment.
But let's face it, the usual challenge from officials when documents are leaked is that they jeopardize national security. The White House has cited that objection in nearly every public statement this week. How do you determine when the critique is legitimate?
You know, if you don't want me to publish something, you don't tell me, well, it's classified. You don't tell me it would damage national security. You tell me a specific security argument about the likely consequences of the disclosure of a particular item of information. And if that argument is at all plausible, I myself am inclined to give it serious consideration.
Stephen, you rightly, I think, pride yourself on having achieved real institutional change. You've compelled the government to declassify, what, hundreds of thousands of documents? Do you feel a little envious of a group like WikiLeaks that can affect the global conversation on such a grand scale?
Well, I would say I'm impressed by WikiLeaks. I mean, I think they literally made headlines in every significant news organization there is. I think they have a long ways to go in developing a code of conduct. I would also say that in the U.S., the political process is still flexible enough that it is possible to put forward an argument for a change in policy and to see that change put into practice. We've seen more than a billion pages of historically valuable records declassified since 1995. So I look with a little bit of concern at the broadsides that WikiLeaks is launching at the classification system. They seem oriented not towards fixing it, but towards defeating it.
But when it comes to crucial information that really needs to get before the public quickly, you sort of remind me of that character in the Indiana Jones film, the guy with the fancy swordplay. Whereas WikiLeaks is like Indiana Jones, he just takes the gun and shoots him. It's a blunt instrument, but it works.
Yeah. I'm talking about systemic reform, which does take a long time. There is a place for leaks. Almost every day in the national news, there is a significant story that involves the unauthorized disclosure of classified information. And that is as it should be, as long as the classification system is applied too broadly.
Even if WikiLeaks is more of a blunt object than you'd like it to be, does the good outweigh the bad?
I think a lot of their talk about fighting injustice is pretty woolly and a little hard to take seriously. Whether the good outweighs the bad, there are lots of potential consequences of just this latest release that may turn out to be really positive and constructive, including a change of course in the war, perhaps. And there are potential consequences that are disastrous, including the potential loss of life and future difficulties in assembling new intelligence networks because sources will lack confidence that the U.S. can keep the secrets it commits to keeping.
All right, Stephen, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Brooke.
Stephen Aftergood is a senior research analyst at the Federation of American Scientists, and he directs the FAS's project on government secrecy. Coming up, go ahead, crack open your iPhone. A new ruling says jailbreaking is legal. This is On the Media from NPR. Hello, pod people. Yeah, I want to sell you something, namely us. On the Media's podcast is free, but it takes a lot of hours to prepare. WNYC shells out a lot for this show, year after year at a loss. But with a little help from each of you, we could easily pay, at least for the podcast. So basically, we're asking you for $10 by texting OTM to 25383. The $10 donation will appear on your phone bill. Text and data rates may apply. I mean, you listen to the podcast because we really do bring you something you don't get elsewhere. OTM is pretty specific, but you can apply what we give you across your whole media life. So if that matters to you, text OTM to 25383. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. When Congress passed the Digital Millennium Copyright Act back in 1998 to protect copyrighted material from being illegally distributed via new media, it was recognized that the law would need regular updates to keep pace with rapidly changing technology. So every 3 years, the Librarian of Congress reviews its provisions and issues exemptions. And this week, results of the latest review were released. The exemption that grabbed the most headlines involved smartphones. Apple had claimed that hacking your iPhone to, say, use non-Apple apps violated the act, which may be why messing with your smartphone is called jailbreaking. But now the Librarian of Congress has determined that jailbreakers are not subject to copyright lawsuits. Jonathan Zittrain of Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society says there are plenty of reasons to jailbreak.
There may be all sorts of applications, including ones that go against the business model of the curator, that people would want to run. So there are people who have submitted email management programs to run on something like the iPhone, and Apple, within its rights, has said, no, we're not going to allow it on the platform because we think it competes with our own mail program on the phone. And so it may well be that as an iPhone user, you want to use something like that. And jailbreaking the phone would be the way to do it. Of course, another big reason to jailbreak the phone would be to try to use a different phone services vendor to move from AT&T, say, to Verizon or something.
Apple keeps a pretty tight hand on its applications. You can submit an idea to Apple. They can either accept it or they can refuse it. They want to create a squeaky clean, what they call, ecosystem for their users. This would compromise that.
Correct. And at the moment, one of the competing phones, the Android phone, in large part sponsored and pushed by Google, is a phone that has an official app store, just kind of like the Apple store, but you can go off-roading if you want. And one big canary in the coal mine will be, for people who use Android phones, how often do they find themselves using applications that may not have merited approval? And how often are those applications ones that turn out to be bad for them, the way that sometimes in our personal computer environment, we end up running applications that we regret later?
As a practical matter, what does this decision really mean for people who have a smartphone like the iPhone? Can they hack their phone? Do they have the tools? Can grandma go to a website and double-click something that will jailbreak her phone?
It's still not clear. The exception just provided to allow people to hack their phones doesn't itself directly apply to trafficking in the tools that let you do the hacking you were just told you can do. So it's a little bit like being told, okay, you're allowed to chisel out a statue from this block of marble, but we're not going to allow you a chisel. Even if you get the chisel, there's still the issue, especially with phones, which are constantly talking back to the mothership to enable their usage, that you're voiding the warranty. You could see the vendor of the phone saying, well, no update for you. Your phone isn't going to work anymore. So-called bricking could take place, where the phone is essentially turned into a brick. This exception just allows game on. It allows the cat and mouse game to continue without the vendor of the phone trying to bring the courts to bear to stop you. But it doesn't mean they can't bring technology to bear.
So unless you have some programming expertise, this isn't going to help you very much. But what about symbolically?
I think symbolically, that's where this decision makes a difference. Here is an official of the United States government declaring that the activity by which you can use the phone however you like is legally protected. And that's important. Even the terminology we use a lot, jailbreaking, hacking, these terms tend to have connotations that suggest a subversive, if not downright illegal activity. I mean, in what other context are we happy when jailbreaking takes place? So I see this decision symbolically as helping to refine a conversation about how much the long arm of the vendor can keep operating after a purchase has been made. And even if, say, an Apple or a Kindle or a Facebook would be entirely within its rights to try to go after you for changing the applications that you can run on their product, it may mean that they'll be more reluctant to do it because it's seen not as a terrible activity, but actually as a salutary one.
And salutary because?
Because one of the lessons we've learned is how much we can be surprised by what those two people in a garage can do. The World Wide Web itself, instant messaging, Skype, peer-to-peer networking, each one of these things originated kind of in a corner and then could find a mainstream audience because there was no central curator to whom a business case had to be made.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Zittrain is professor of law at Harvard Law School and co-director of Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Not everything that counts can be counted. Not everything that can be counted counts. This quote from Albert Einstein opens the book of essays titled Sex, Drugs, and Body Counts, The Politics of Numbers in Global Crime and Conflict. As its editors note, many of the numbers we encounter in the media are problematic at best. Some are inflated, like the profits from the global drug trade. Some are deflated, like casualty figures in Darfur. And still others are simply pulled out of the thinnest of air. The book is a series of case studies that together illustrate how numbers are used, abused, proliferated, recycled, and even laundered. Brown University political science professor Peter Andreas co-edited the volume, and he says that numbers are even chosen because of how they'll sound on the news.
We're not only more likely to remember the first number that we've heard, but we're likely to remember a big round number. So, for example, when the United Nations announces, as it did several decades ago, that the global drug trade was worth $500 billion, that's a memorable number. They later lowered that estimate to $400 billion, and an economist within the UN started questioning why that number, and apparently they rounded it up from 365 because it would, well, play better in the media and be more memorable.
There's also the fact that we hate feeling uncertainty, especially about the issues we care most about.
Absolutely. The Bosnia death toll case is a particularly striking illustration. In the midst of the war in the early 1990s, the Bosnian government, under extraordinary pressure, desperate circumstances, being asked by other governments and by the media, you know, what are the casualty numbers? And so at a press conference, they simply threw out a number, 200,000 or 250,000. That became the sort of taken for granted numerical range. Years after the war, a research center in Sarajevo did this meticulous research that found that the number was probably half that much.
What is the number that you think the world remembers today?
The number the world remembers today is 200,000 to 250,000 people died in the war in Bosnia. You know, it's interesting here because Bosnia is rightly understood as a case of genocide, but the definition of genocide does not depend on numbers of people killed. It's about intention. So the massacre at Srebrenica in early July of 1995 killed 7,000 to 8,000 people, and that the international community has rightly categorized as an act of genocide. But there was such a political commitment to this larger aggregate number that to then challenge the number implies that you're diminishing the horrendous war the country went through and the toll it took on its population.
You wrote a chapter that focuses on global crime. As you note, these kinds of numbers are inherently hard to generate. It's not as if drug smugglers or human traffickers file quarterly reports.
Exactly.
But the problem here, you note, is particularly acute because mythical numbers are perpetuated by seemingly credible organizations like governments or Interpol or the United Nations. You'd assume they'd have solid research to back up their numbers, but that's not the case.
It's pretty murky and, in fact, invisible where some of these numbers come from. If you actually look at the annual State Department report, which comes out every March 1st, basically evaluating the anti-drug efforts of countries around the world, it's essentially a report card from the United States to the rest of the world. Some of it is simply blocked off as classified, so you just don't have access to the methodology, the data. Then the issue is, okay, even given the numbers, what actually do those numbers mean? So if we're told by the State Department that X country, say Mexico or Colombia or Peru, has eradicated record numbers of coca crops or poppy fields, we are supposed to cheer. But what they don't necessarily tell you is how much new acreage there may be. Same with border interdiction numbers. So we get regularly bombarded with statistics over how many seizures are made at the border of cocaine or heroin or whatnot. But what does this mean? All things being equal, if they're seizing more, it might actually mean more drugs overall are coming through. And in fact, if they're seizing less, it also might mean that fewer drugs are coming through. But the political pressure from Washington, and then it plays itself out in the press, is to beef up seizure statistics, even though, frankly, you can read those numbers in all sorts of ways.
You quote Slate's Jack Schaefer, deftly summarizing the use of numbers by the media. He wrote, "Reporters have so much faith in the pure power of numbers that many will inject into a piece any ones available, as long as they are one, big, 2, come from a seemingly authoritative source, and 3, don't contradict the point the reporter is trying to make.
Absolutely. The State Department put out a number several years ago that 600,000 to 800,000 people have been trafficked every year. This immediately made headlines, including, I should say, NPR, but also the New York Times and elsewhere. Now, the Government Accountability Office, sort of the investigative research branch of Congress, then issued a report seriously questioning the number, just showing how methodologically flawed it is, and you barely heard a peep. So, frankly, the State Department's 600,000 to 800,000 trafficked every year is, in many circles, the sort of accepted number.
So the media often have as great a stake in these numbers as policymakers do.
Journalists on deadline looking to fill a blank space, they need a number for their story to actually be a story. But unfortunately, the more common tendency is to report a scary big number and then not really follow up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Brown University Professor Peter Andreas is co-editor with Kelly M. Greenhill of Sex, Drugs, and Body Counts, The Politics of Numbers in Global Crime and Conflict. Most numbers, however shoddy, have at the very least an original source. There are some, though, that appear to lack even that. 4 years ago, we delved into the mysterious number, said to be 50,000, of child predators online at any given time. It was cited by the NBC Dateline program to catch a predator, and also by then-Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. But spokespersons for the FBI, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and the Crimes Against Children Research Center said it was not based on any research they were aware of. The AG's office at the time, well, they said it came from Dateline.
It was attributed to, you know, law enforcement as an estimate, and it was talked about as sort of an extrapolated number.
Chris Hansen is a reporter for the Dateline series.
So when we went to interview Ken Lanning, who was the expert we talked to in our first piece, I said, look, this number keeps surfacing. Do you think that it's accurate, it's reliable? And he essentially said to me, I've heard it, but depending on how you define what is a predator, it could actually be a very low estimate.
He took that as confirmation, but maybe he shouldn't have.
I didn't know where it came from. I couldn't confirm it, but I couldn't refute it either. But I felt it was a fairly reasonable figure.
That's Hansen's source, FBI veteran Ken Lanning.
I was somewhat curious about the fact that it was 50,000. That number had popped up in the past because I had been an FBI agent for over 30 years. In the early 1980s, this was the number that was most often used to estimate how many children were kidnapped or abducted by strangers every year. But the research that was done in the early 1990s found that somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 to 300 children every year were abducted in this manner.
It seems bad things don't come in threes. They come in 50,000.
The other one that I specifically remember kind of came in the late 80s, where there were a lot of people who were talking about satanic cults that were supposedly running around the country, engaging in human sacrifices. And when you try to say, well, how much of this is going on, once again, the same number popped up, 50,000 a year.
Sacrificed?
Yes, that's what they were alleging. This one here was a little bit more obviously problematic to me because we do have good data on homicide. And at that time, there was somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 23,000 murders every year. So this meant that the Satanists all by themselves were killing twice as many people as all the other murderers combined.
So why is 50,000 such an unaccountably sticky figure?
Maybe the appeal of the number was that it wasn't a real small number. It wasn't like 100, 200, and it wasn't a ridiculously large number like 10 million. It was like a Goldilocks number, not too hot, not too cold.
Carl Bialik tracks down dubious numbers in his column for the Wall Street Journal.
An interesting phenomenon of these numbers is that they'll often be cited to an agency or some government body. And then a study will pick it up, and then the press will repeat it from that study. And then once it appears in the press, public officials will repeat it again, and now it's become an official number.
Steve Ross, a former professor at Columbia University's School of Journalism, who taught a class on reporting numbers, says journalists have their own reasons for ornamenting their stories with digits.
Look, 30, 40 years ago, ever since I've been in the business, the editor will come down to you and say, add a number. It builds credibility. Got to have a number in there.
But when it comes to crime, a good number is hard to find.
The only reasonably accurate national crime statistics come out of something called the Uniform Crime Report. The Uniform Crime Report only tracks 8 different crimes: rape, murder, auto theft, that sort of thing. If it's not a crime that is tracked, child pornography is not tracked, for instance, there is no hard and fast national number that comes out of that. The very best, it's a number that's extrapolated from a more limited survey.
Dateline reporter Chris Hansen.
There's a natural tendency to try to quantify a problem. I think we all do it.
So you think you'll continue to use that number?
We used it in the first 2 stories, and we haven't used it in the last 3.
But in terms of changing the previous stories, or I know that they may be rebroadcast at MSNBC, you'll just leave them as they stand.
Well, I don't think that decision's been made yet.
The strongest form of media bias is probably a reporter's bias for his or her own story.
Wall Street Journal numbers guy, Carl Bialik.
And when you find a number that backs up the thesis you've adopted for your story, it can be really hard to pass it up.
Add to that the mysterious allure of 50,000, applied to mayhem ranging from Korean War casualties to the annual death toll from secondhand smoke. I tossed it to former journalism prof Steve Ross. If I were to throw that number out to you as if it were a Jeopardy answer, what might you guess the question would be?
How many traffic deaths are there in the United States every year?
How about how many people are killed a year because of satanic human sacrifice?
I would doubt that it is very many. But I've heard 50,000.
The FBI's Fanning says there may well be 50,000 sexual predators trawling the net. He doesn't know. He does know that 50,000 is the Goldilocks of crime stats. But as experience shows, that doesn't mean it's just right. Coming up, the co-founders of Time Magazine, one forever famous, the other entirely forgotten. And the people choose our new newspaper jingle. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This month, Time Magazine put its content behind a paywall. Former Time Magazine managing editor Walter Isaacson quotes Time co-founder Henry Luce, saying that supporting a publication solely on ad revenue was morally abhorrent and economically self-defeating. Luce, who died nearly 40 years ago, believed a publication's primary duty was to its readers, not to its advertisers. These days, many consider the 87-year-old magazine something of a dinosaur, but at its birth, it was nothing short of revolutionary, a revolution hatched by 2 men, the legendary Luce and Britton Haddon, an eccentric, electric visionary who first dreamed up the idea of a news digest written in short, punchy prose. Luce loved and hated Haddon in equal measure and made sure the world forgot him. There's a new biography of Luce out, and we'll get to that in a few minutes, but to broaden the context, we'll replay this interview about Britton Haddon with Isaiah Wilner, author of The Man Time Forgot. Wilner describes how the idea for Time took shape when Haddon was still a boy.
Haddon went off to school one day in Brooklyn Heights, and he spoke with a friend who was a Democrat. He'd never really spoken with a Democrat before. He thought the Republicans were in the right, and so he came home from school that day completely shocked. And he told his parents, you know, when I grow up, I'm going to start a magazine that will tell the facts for once and for all. And then there won't be all this confusion about who's right. Then the idea continued to develop throughout Hotchkiss. And that's where he met Luce. Luce had traveled all over Europe, you know, before the age of 15. He was the son of missionaries. He was very shy, lonely. He stuttered. And he was attracted to Haddon almost instantly because Haddon was this glamorous boy who was always cracking jokes, always in the center of the action. So they struck up this rivalry, and the rivalry was what really caused them to get together and ultimately fall in love. They became very close working partners.
They were fighting for the editorship of the paper, just as they went on to fight for the chairmanship of the paper when they were students together at Yale.
When Luce lost the chairmanship of the Yale Daily News to Haddon, it really hit him hard. And in fact, he never really recovered from it. From that moment on, he was quite envious of Haddon. And yet, he was still sucked into Haddon's aura. The First World War interrupted their collegiate experience. They were sent down south to Camp Jackson. And it was there, when they were training to become officers, that they started training some younger, less educated men. It was in the experience of training these men that Haddon and Luce realized, for example, that many Americans were illiterate, that they knew very little about the world. And that was when they got together and decided it would be up to them to solve the problem of human ignorance.
Not the problem of illiteracy, but of ignorance.
Yeah, well, I think it played into ideas that Haddon had already, you know. He didn't want to be a teacher. He wanted to be a journalist.
Luce wanted to be a teacher. He wanted to tell people not just what the news was, but how they ought to think about it and what conclusions they ought to draw.
Luce had inherited a worldview from his father, being a missionary. And Luce, in fact, became a kind of media missionary. Time was his vehicle more than a method of distributing the news. It was a way of getting his opinions out, you know, his view of what America's role in the world should be.
What do you think, ultimately, the impact of Time magazine was on American journalism?
Well, I think it was Time more than any single publication that turned the news into a form of entertainment. There were certainly others before, such as, you know, Hearst and Pulitzer. However, you would have the tabloids and sensational newspapers on the one hand. Then on the other hand, you'd have something like the New York Times, which was pretty complicated, a lot of big words, and really only the elite of the elite would read it. So what Time was able to do was have an entertaining writing style similar to a Hearst newspaper, a little classier and more for the middle class. And then at the same time, they were able to get across everything that you truly needed to know, at least to appear informed.
The original idea, as you describe it, was to create a new voice, a new kind of syntax for news. Short sentences, double-barreled adjectival phrases drawn from Homer. In fact, you note that a volume of the Iliad was always on Haddon's desk.
That's right. And one of the things that really attracted him was the Homeric epithet, such as, you know, the phrase helm-quivering Hector. So Haddon picked this up as a way of getting Americans to remember, you know, who was Winston Churchill. So he would use the phrase, ruddy as a round full moon.
And he called Russian revolutionary Grigory Zinoviev the bomb boy of Bolshevism. If you didn't know who he was when he first mentioned it, after that little epithet, you were absolutely caught up.
Oh, it was just seared in the mind, yeah. This was the age before television, you know. Back then, people couldn't really see these far-off places that they had never been to. And so these epithets were a way of getting people to see the news in their mind's eye.
What were some of the most significant differences in perspective between Haddon and Luce?
Well, Haddon, you know, he was an eccentric guy, and he had a critical view of the business society of the 1920s. And so he actually started another magazine called Tide, which was critical of the whole advertising industry. Luce was very uncomfortable with Tide. Luce wanted to do a different type of business magazine, which later came to be called Fortune.
Which Haddon was against.
Oh, he was totally opposed to Fortune. He thought it was just business boosterism. And at the end of their life, they were really coming to a final confrontation over this.
Haddon died in a Brooklyn hospital, age 31, maybe because of a strep infection that damaged his heart, maybe because of alcoholism, some said. Someone in your book even suggested that he died at least partly of boredom.
It was clear that Haddon was wasting away. The doctors were desperate to help him, but they had no idea what they could do. And it was at this time that Luce came to Haddon's deathbed. And the rumor that went through Time in later years was that Luce came at that moment and asked Haddon to sell him enough shares in Time, Inc. to ensure Luce's majority control of the company. All that we know is that Haddon, at that moment, brought in his roommate and asked him to write up a will. He was so weak that he could only sign with a hash mark. And he said that none of his stock in Time, Inc. should be sold for 49 years because Haddon believed the company would be a success. But if his will were to be followed to the letter, Luce would never really be able to run the company. Actually, when Haddon died, there was a black notebook that was found among his things. And on one page titled Expansion, he had written all of his ideas for the future of the company. This included the idea for Sports Illustrated, Life, to expand Time onto the cinema and onto the radio. All of these ideas were followed through on in the next several years. And yet this black notebook was folded into Time's archive, and nobody really knew that it existed.
How, in the end, did Henry Luce bury, and I mean really bury, Britton Haddon?
Well, Luce was heartbroken by the loss of Haddon, but within 2 weeks of Haddon's death, Luce had actually taken Haddon's name off the masthead of Time magazine. Within a year, Luce had broken Haddon's will. He kept a lot of the stock for himself, but he distributed many shares to his closest friends and allies, so that ensured his permanent control of the company. And then, for the next 19 years, he never said anything about Haddon. Finally, after 20 years, he did publish a book about Haddon, and that's when the fiction began to spread that Henry Luce was equally responsible for the idea for Time. He never really talked about Haddon's genius. Haddon had not only come up with the idea, he had hired all of the writers, developed the writing style, and it's strange that this would happen because they were such great friends.
All right. Isaiah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Isaiah Wilner is the author of The Man Time Forgot. Columbia University history professor Alan Brinkley is author of the new biography, The Publisher, Henry Luce and His American Century. Brinkley doesn't agree that Luce in the end betrayed Haddon. Rather, he says Luce was simply a businessman asserting his control.
It's not as if he set about destroying memories of Haddon. It's just that he was very insecure when Haddon died and was frightened that he would not be able to mobilize the staff around him. And so I think he felt that it was important to establish himself as the head of the company.
And to do that, in part, launched Fortune magazine.
I think there were two things that led to Fortune magazine. One was that he felt that Time magazine was Brit Haddon's magazine, and he wanted a magazine of his own. And secondly, he wanted to create a business magazine that would be unlike any other business magazine, that would explore the character of capitalism. He believed in a kind of business success that would spread wealth widely among the people, both through labor policies that would elevate the wealth of workers, but also through the growth of industry, which he saw as part of the great mission of American life. And that's what Fortune tried to promote.
He launched Life magazine how many years after Fortune?
6 years, 1936.
What did Luce see as the mission for that magazine?
He wanted to create the most beautiful and riveting picture magazine ever published, and it was that. It was a magazine that could project a vision of what America was like, or at least what he wanted America to be like. Luce believed that under everything else, there was a united America. There was a single culture that everyone was part of. And that's what Life magazine projected into the world, a sense of a kind of consensual America. That was not an accurate picture of what America was like. And by the time that he retired in 1964, this vision was collapsing around him, and Life became a very different kind of magazine as well.
So he launched Fortune in 1930, in 1936, Life magazine. In 1935, another important acquisition, his second wife, Claire Booth Luce, an ambitious journalist, later an ambassador. But their marriage seemed to be more of a partnership than a love affair. Am I wrong?
It started out as a love affair. He was besotted by her, and it was sudden, very sudden. They met at a party in the Waldorf Astoria, and by the end of the evening, he was proposing marriage.
For such a cautious man, that seems
yes.
to be rather a rush to judgment. And a married man, no less.
He was a married man, and it seemed a happily married man. But suddenly, Claire Booth Luce just shattered everything else around him, and he pursued her until she agreed to marry him. It was in many ways a disastrous marriage. They both had affairs. Luce twice tried to divorce her and marry somebody else. She fought back, and she won. In the late 50s, he met a woman named Jean Campbell, who was the granddaughter of Lord Beaverbrook, the great publisher in Britain. They had a torrid relationship that Claire eventually found out about. And the writings of Claire are really something to see. Let me just give you first an example of the titles of the essays that she wrote to herself. A Memorandum on Bitterness. Go in Peace or Stay in Peace. Suspicious of HRL's Motives. A Questionnaire on Love and Warmth. What Happens to Me Without You? And then here's a letter that she wrote. The wounds continue raw and bleeding. you also have wounded quite as badly my femininity. I do not own 1 acre or brick of any of our homes. The paintings Harry gave me for birthdays and Christmases were not really gifts to me, but the property of Harry's estate.
So the pains were both personal and practical.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
He remained throughout his life fascinated with China. Didn't Chiang Kai-shek appear on the cover of Time 10 times?
He appeared often, including Man and Woman of the Year, the only time that ever happened, Chiang Kai-shek and Madame Chiang Kai-shek. The more unpopular Chiang Kai-shek became in China, the more support he got from Luce.
Why?
He believed that Chiang Kai-shek was one of the great figures of history. And Luce cared so much about the future of China and of making China a sort of modern democratic nation. He saw Chiang Kai-shek as the only hope for that. But he ignored or dismissed all of the things that Chiang Kai-shek did badly, and there were many such things. Teddy White, the famous Time magazine editor in China, they both believed in Chiang Kai-shek. But Teddy White lost that belief and began to write about Chiang Kai-shek as someone who had failed. And Luce was furious, and that led to his departure from Time, Inc.
In 1941, Luce published an editorial in Life magazine called The American Century. Why did it become so important?
The American Century was in part a piece of propaganda to prepare Americans for their inevitable entry into World War II. But part of what he thought needed to be said was that this war was going to transform America into the great nation of the world, maybe the great nation of world history. So let me read just a passage of this because it's really quite extraordinary. We are the inheritors of all the great principles of Western civilization, above all justice, the love of truth, the ideal of charity. It now becomes our time to be the powerhouse from which the ideals spread throughout the world and do their mysterious work of lifting the life of mankind from the level of the beasts to what the psalmist called a little lower than the angels.
Could have been written by Teddy Roosevelt.
It could have been. And in fact, it was inspired by a valedictory address that he gave at Yale, quoting Theodore Roosevelt.
And is it precisely therein where most of the criticism of Henry Luce centers, a kind of blinkered chauvinism, perhaps, a blindness to America's own failings?
Well, to the left in particular, especially in the 40s and 50s when the communist left was still a significant force, they hated these ideas that America would be the great capitalist leader of the world. But equally infuriating to readers of the magazine who just wanted a magazine that would sound fair in the treatment of politics. In much of the 40s and 50s, Time magazine was not fair. By 1952, there hadn't been a Republican president in 20 years, and Luce was desperate to see a Republican elected president. And he loved Eisenhower. And through the whole 8 years of his presidency, the magazine was constantly supporting and admiring Eisenhower. And it infuriated many readers, although not too many gave up their subscriptions.
What do you think his magazines did for America?
Well, I think the part of Luce magazine that might be the most revealing is a feature that was very popular in the 30s and 40s called Life Goes to a Party. Lots of glittering, wealthy people having parties in sensational settings. Also, people having proms in high school gyms and people dancing in Harlem and people having reunions in fields in Iowa. Life Goes to a Party was consistently upbeat and embracing. And it gave you a sense that everybody has the same goals, to be happy, to be Americans. Life Goes to a Party was the epitome of what life represented, I think.
Everybody has a party to go to in life.
In life, that's right.
Alan, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Alan Brinkley is professor of American history at Columbia University. His book, The Publisher, Henry Luce and His American Century, is published by Knopf. And finally, 2 weeks ago, we asked you to choose a new jingle from a slate of contenders to be played when we discuss present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry. We got a big response. Actually, many of you liked the old one best, like John Maylene, who wrote, "In the name of all that is holy, keep the original jingle. It makes me smile every time I hear it." But as Aaron Burton wrote, "I like the old one too, but sometimes things have to change, I guess." We agree, Aaron. Sometimes you just have to give the barn a new coat of paint. So, in keeping with that rural metaphor, we give you the winning jingle.
Present and future business models to monetize the newspaper industry.
Who knows? Maybe the newspaper industry will figure out how to monetize itself and we can retire the jingle altogether. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Wolo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, with more help from Brett Jaspers and Michael Chaplin, and edited by me. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and engineering help from Dylan Keith. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. This is On the Media from WNYC. Bob Garfield won't be back next week, but he'll be back at some point. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from Random House, publisher of The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet by David Mitchell, a love story set in turn of the 19th century Japan. The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet by David Mitchell, now in hardcover. On the Media is also supported by the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.